It sometimes seems
like God just kind of just isn't listening. That things are just going on and on and on, just the same way they have been, the same messes, the same problems, and it seems like God just isn't listening, even to His own promises to us. Whenever God is delaying, it's for His own glory and for His own purposes. God doesn't rule the world, the universe, in accordance with my direction. He's never come to me for advice. I don't expect He ever will. He doesn't show me His calendar. He doesn't give me a pen so I can mark on it. God does things His own way. He does it in His own time. And this is an example here in the book of Exodus that we're coming up to a great showing of God's power when He's finally hearing the prayers of the people that have been praying for centuries, really. Well, we think it's been for a while. It's been at least 40 years. It's probably been a lot longer than that. So Exodus chapter 2, verse 23. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. And the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage. And they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took note of them. After many days. It says that God remembered the covenant that He had with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Hundreds of years before this. The first thing we have to ask ourselves is, what was this covenant? And this is this little detail. You guys don't have to follow me on this because I'm only going to be there for a little while. Okay? So Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15. Down in verse 13. Down in the 13. This tells us, what in the world was Abraham's covenant? What was this promise that God remembered? Why was it so important that now when He remembered it, it meant really the shaking of the world in a way it had never been shaken before? God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. Hello. Now we're at the other end of this. God had predicted way back in Abram's time, I mean, that was 500 or 600 years, most likely, before this event that we're reading about in Exodus. And God predicted not only that they will be enslaved and oppressed, but how long it was going to be. 400 years. The people should have known at this time that something was about to happen. I get the impression in Exodus that neither Moses nor the people were really calling God accountable to His promises, but rather that they had forgotten not only the timetable, but the promise itself. Verse 14, "But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between those pieces. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite.'" That was the promise. That was the deed given to the people of Israel. That was the land. The Jews never possessed that extent of land in all the histories. I believe they came close with David and Solomon. They came close. But the whole land from the Nile to the Euphrates, that's a big chunk of real estate. That's a big chunk of real estate. That's like, you know, part of Egypt in our modern day, all of Israel, I believe, all of Jordan, part of Syria, part of Lebanon, part of Iraq. You know, just, it just really is quite a massive piece of real estate. So that was the promise that God remembered. And so when you keep that promise sort of in your mind, now back to Exodus, this time chapter 3. That was the promise that God remembered. And we'll see in Exodus chapter 3, sometimes almost word for word, God recounting that promise to Moses and telling Moses, this is it. You're the guy. We're going to do it. Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. By the way, we don't know where Horeb is nowadays. We kind of sort of, there have been a couple of different suggestions where it is. We're not exactly sure. But Moses was, it was somewhere on the west side of the wilderness. We don't know which wilderness. And so that's why the location is kind of uncertain. So this was probably something that he did all the time, right? Day after day. We may mention last week that we had Moses, big man in Pharaoh's household, prince of Egypt, the royal household, destined for some kind of job. Probably not destined for the throne, but probably destined for something important. You know, the movie Prince of Egypt has him being the master builder. That's a possible role for a member of the royal household. Of course, that's just theorizing or speculating. And so instead, day by day, he was pasturing the flock. This day he did it like he always did. Verse 2. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. Right? How bizarre. He had a bush that was on fire, but yet it wasn't being consumed. It wasn't burning down. A bush should burn pretty fast. Right? If you catch a bush on fire, it's more or less whoosh, and it burns for a little bit, and then it's gone. But here we had the bush that just kept burning and burning and burning. As a shepherd in the wilderness, he most likely had seen bushes burn before with lightning strikes and whatnot. So he knew that this was odd. This was a weird thing. So verse 3, so Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. Verse 4. And it's sort of interesting here. I've made mention before of this interesting being that shows up in the Old Covenant, the angel of the Lord. And start out in verse 2, the angel of the Lord appeared to him. And in verse 4, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses! And he said, here I am. We have to admire, by the way, Moses' faith at this point, or maybe it was something supernatural from God, because if a bush that was on fire started speaking to me, my first temptation would have been to turn around and head out. But instead, Moses said, here I am. Here I am. Which is the traditional response when God is calling to you in Scripture, is simply, here I am. In other words, I am ready to hear what you have to say, Lord. Then he said, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. What made the ground holy? The presence of God is what made and sanctified that. People remove their sandals, by the way, because of a notion of just how sinful and inadequate they were to stand before God in a holy place. And Moses certainly realized that. And so you can just picture Moses in the middle of this wilderness with a bush that is burning and him kneeling near it. Verse 6. He also said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. It had been hundreds of years since anybody in the family had heard from God. I mean, in our study of Genesis, we saw how God spoke to those people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob, in particular, saw visions of God, that God spoke to him, that he heard from God. But after Jacob, nothing. Hundreds of years of silence before now God chose this place, that day, and that place in the middle of the wilderness. Not in the middle of town, not among the leaders of Israel back in Egypt, but way out in the wilderness to this guy who had really murdered someone and been fleeing and now had spent 40 years in no man's land, that God chose that man to reveal himself to. Verse 7, the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the, right from the words of the covenant that he made with Abraham, Canaanite and Hittite, and the Amorite, and Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Somehow it seems like they might have forgotten, the Jewish people, of what their destiny ought to have been. That they were just caught up in all the sufferings and sorrows that maybe they'd forgotten. Doesn't seem when Moses went and talked to the leadership or even in the wanderings in the wilderness that they really had a good grasp of the fact that this was their home that God was talking about. This was the place that they were given by God. Verse 9, now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. I'm sure there was a pregnant pause after that. Verse 11, but Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? I mean, just think in our day, somebody, you know, God gives you a message or a vision that, hey, you're the man or the woman that I'm choosing to go talk to the president. And you're thinking, yeah, right. Secret Service, appointment calendars, yeah, rich and the powerful, get in there. How am I going to get in there? You're not going to see me. You're not going to want to talk to me. And that's pretty much what Moses' attitude was. Maybe there is something else going on there too, and Moses' attitude is like, look, you know, my reputation back in Egypt is not the best right now. I didn't exactly leave there on favorable terms. They didn't tell me see you later when I left. So who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Verse 12. And he said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. I'm sure if I were Moses, I'd be tempted to say, that's not a sign. God said to Moses, here's your sign that when you have delivered the people, you're going to worship me here. And Moses is like, excuse me, that's not my problem. My problem is not after I deliver the people. The problem is the delivering part itself. But God doesn't give him the sign to deal with his lack of faith. Instead, God says, don't worry. I'll see you back here. I'll see you back here. You're going to deliver them from Egypt. On one hand, you got to stop and think that Moses should have felt pretty good about this because, after all, he was talking to a burning bush. I mean, if you want a sign, that's a pretty good one right there. That's a pretty good one right there. So Moses is not exactly a willing messenger. He does eventually cross the line. I don't think in this passage we're talking about today, but maybe the next time we talk about Moses, where he crosses the line with God and he turns God down. But at this point, God is still patient with him because he's dealing with honest questions. Verse 13, then Moses said to God, "Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' Now they may say to me, 'What is his name?' What shall I say to them?" This kind of gives you an idea of what their heart is. They're in Egypt with all its bunches of gods. You would think that they would have known that the God who appeared to their fathers wasn't like their other gods. Didn't have a name. I mean, there's all sorts of... Each god of Egypt had its own name and its own specialty, if you would. The god of the Nile, the god of the underworld, the god of this and the god of that. And so maybe Moses is asking, well, where do you fit in? And God gives him a response. God gives him a response that I don't think he was expecting. Verse 14, God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" I always marvel at how when it takes mankind, we write books that are hundreds and hundreds and thousands of pages, and they're all instantly forgettable. I've read, I've got books in my library, I've got books on my bookshelves, I've got books piled in front of my bookshelves, I got books piled on my floor. My son shaking his head saying, "Yeah, he's seen my office, he knows what it looks like." Upstairs I've got bookshelves with books there, and I got books in the TV room, I got books everywhere. And there are very few books that say very profound things. And you get little tidbits here and there, and some people have some really profound, really ideas to bring forth. But God can just take one sentence and reveal such profundity in it, like this one. "I am who I am." Just trying to figure out all that thing. There are books and books and books that have been written just on that one statement that God has said, "I am who I am." He wasn't just one of these idols in Egypt. He wasn't just one of these false gods, these things of gold and silver and bronze. He was not like that at all. He was the God who was pre-existing, who exists because he exists. What purpose does God serve? Well, he serves his own purpose. Who made God? Well, nobody. God exists because he exists. He is because he is. I am because I am. By the way, this is not the Tetragrammaton, the Yod Heh Vav Heh. This is slightly different. It is the future tense of the to be verb, so it's a different word. Eyah is the word in Hebrew. Eyah Asher Eyah. I am who I am. So it's sort of interesting that he didn't give him the name that he was known to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He didn't give the Yod Heh Vav Heh to give to the people. Instead, he gave this new term that I am. God's the only one who is pre-existent and post-existent and current existent, and he's just there. He exists on his own power. He exists on his own nature. Nothing else in the universe is that true of. The universe exists because God wills it. Nothing in the universe exists just because. The universe itself doesn't exist just because. The universe was handcrafted by God. The universe was a made thing. God himself is not. God can say, "I am. I am who I am." God furthermore said to Moses, Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. In verse 15, it is the traditional Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. When he calls himself the Lord, he uses that name again in order to refer to himself. Yeshua, in one of his declarations to them in John chapter 8, said, Before Abraham was born, I am, identifying himself with this nature of this unchangeable, everlasting God. The people understood exactly what he was referring to because they took up stones to throw them at him. Verse 16. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So interesting, because in a way it's a test of faith for them. God didn't appear to them. They got to believe this guy coming in off the desert, Moses, who comes and says, God appeared to me. In some way, maybe it's humble pie for them that they have to stop and say, well, you know, why didn't God appear to us? Maybe we're not as hot stuff as God thinks, as we think we are. This has parallels in many places in God's dealing with mankind. It shows up in Yeshua's life that Yeshua was not born in the center of Jerusalem, in and among the leaders of the land. He was born off in the sticks, as it were. Just as Moses, the shepherd, was the only one to view the revelation of God in the bush, so the shepherds were the only ones to view the revelation of God in Yeshua. So we have some parallels here, just the way that God works. Verse 18, They will pay heed to what you say, and you with the elders of Israel. I'm sorry, I think it's just the verse. Verse 17, So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite and Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, to land flowing with milk and honey. They will pay heed to what you say, and you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now, please, let us go a 3 days' journey in the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. In other words, it's a small request, an easy request. But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. That was also mentioned in the covenant of Abraham, that they would go out with many possessions. Verse 22, But every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians. So God is answering this prayer, certainly not in the way that anybody would have predicted, is it? I mean, if we were to set out kind of the game plan of how, you know, if we were acting on God's behalf, or we were planning this out for God, if he did give us a blank sheet of paper in the year, you know, that Moses, even before Moses was born, and God sent us a piece of paper and said, here, plan out this redemption, what would you do? I don't think it would be to take this guy, put him in the royal house, and then throw him out in the wilderness for 40 years, and then appear to him so that he would have to go back to the leaders of Israel and convince them that he really did speak to God, and then talk to the king of the Pharaoh of Egypt and convince him that they had really seen God and that he should let them go, and so on and so forth. But all of this was that God did do, was working out so that God and God alone would get the glory. Moses could really say at the end of this that really he contributed very little to this effort. In fact, when we see in the future readings that we are going to do, the future studying we do, that Moses was spectacularly unsuccessful in the beginning. Even with the elders of Israel, he came and talked to the elders of Israel and they wouldn't listen to him. And then the king of Egypt made it worse, and so on and so forth. So that the initial part of his career as deliverer was not a very successful one. But God still showed his power through all this. So God answers prayer in his own time and in his own way. That is the constant message of Scripture. And we, I guess, maybe we think because we are so smart in our day that we've got everything together. You know, we got our BlackBerries and we got our Outlook calendars and we got all the rest of the things. We want God's actual plan here. We like to write it down. We like to get it on our calendar. We like to put maybe, you know, those little alarm notifications that pop up that says God's about to do something. God doesn't act like that. He doesn't take our ideas, because I think, and I hope this isn't a shock to anybody, God is a lot smarter than we are, and he knows everything, whereas we know so very little, that God plans this stuff, and when it does show up, then we just got to sit back and say, wow, look at that. And there are things in my life that I've looked at that have just been like, things just lining up in such a way that at the end of it, you stop and say, wow, how did God do this? It's like, well, you know, this depended on that, and that depended on that, and this just had to have split-second timing. This other thing had to happen. It's like, wow, look at that. I couldn't have done that. Well, no, you're right. You couldn't. Our schemes are as nothing compared to the power of God. And sometimes, when you've been praying and praying and praying and praying, and nothing happens, you know what you should do? Keep praying and praying and praying and praying. Because God, these people have been praying for decades to be delivered, at least, most likely centuries. And it looked for a while like nothing was happening. But something was happening. I mean, even these last 40 years, something was happening. Not what they would have expected. I mean, if somebody would have asked God, well, what are you doing about this? He said, well, I got this guy out in the wilderness. It's like, does he have an army? No. Does he have, like, political connections? Well, not anymore. Does he have, is he, like, big and strong and burly? No. Oh, okay. So what you up to? You know, God would have to say, wait, you'll see. And now, depending on what date you look at for the Exodus, it's either 3,200 years ago or 400 or 500 years ago, I would favor more the early date, 3,500 years ago, all this happened. And we're reading about it today because it was such a remarkable thing that God was so glorified in it, that these tremendous miracles that had occurred, that it's still really, in our day, we still marvel at it. So when God is delaying, it's not because he's forgotten or he's off doing something else. It's because he's got a plan. And the plan extends beyond us, beyond the fact that we're amused today or not, into really the workings of the whole world. And here he was arranging all this so that his name would be mightily glorified in the Egyptian people and even in our own day, as you look back and see all the wonders that God did in freeing the people from Egypt, that it is a great testimony to his great power and his great covenant keeping. Because remember, it said he did this, he remembered his covenant with Abraham, that God kept his promises even over hundreds of years, and keep his promises to us too. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for in our life all the great things that you have done, all the wonders that you have worked in order to get us from where we were to where we needed to be. I ask that you calm our hearts as we look at the trouble in our own life, that we understand your faithfulness, and that we understand that you are quite up to whatever challenge we can put before you, that our problems are easily solvable by you. Help us to live lives free of bitterness and anxiety, but that instead we might rest in you and in your promises and in your power, and that everything we do and say might glorify you and glorify our Messiah Yeshua. Amen.